This is an ABC podcast.
This is The Conversation Hour
on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
And good morning. My name's Rochelle Hunt and I'm in Melbourne.
And my name's Michaela Ortolan and I'm in Wodonga.
And Michaela, today we're looking at two new alternative and slightly edgy treatments that are being trialled here in Victoria for drug and alcohol dependency. The first is ayahuasca. Now, you may not have heard of this, or you may have heard celebrities spruiking it on late night TV shows or talking about it in their latest memoir. It's a psychedelic drug that some say is like an awakening, an accelerated process that can be like 10 years of psychotherapy in one night. Well, believe it or not, a trial of ayahuasca for alcohol dependency as well as depression is being led by the Florey Institute of Neuroscience and Mental Health with Melbourne's St Vincent's Hospital and Swinburne University. So two very well-respected institutions. And that trial is due to commence later this year.
It's quite edgy and much more edgier than this other trial, which is looking at CBD oil. Now, that's much more common and widespread. You may have heard of it or know someone who's used it when it comes to treating things like epilepsy or chronic pain, mm-hmm. or even just to help you sleep. So the effects of cannabis oil on marijuana users and its potential for treating addiction will be subject of a 12-week trial in regional Victoria. Now, researchers with the Goulburn Valley Alcohol and Drug Service in Shepparton are looking for local volunteers to participate in the study, which will examine the possible benefits of CBD, which is a chemical found in the cannabis plant.
So isn't this interesting? Two separate trials using drugs for drug and alcohol treatment. So ayahuasca and CBD oil, both of these trials to commence here in Victoria this year. So how legitimate are these new treatments? What do the professionals think? And would you consider being a part of a trial?
My friend, the witch doctor, he taught me what to say. My friend, the witch doctor, he taught me what to do. I know that you'll be my...
So is it all just a little bit of witch doctoring, or are these legitimate trials that can be used in the array of other treatments that we know already work when it comes to drug and alcohol addiction? Before we speak to those, Michaela, behind the trial, let's go to Dr. Shanili Aragani, I should say, who's the Deputy Director of Turning Point Drug and Alcohol Centre. Shalini, is this all just a bit of witch doctoring, or are these legitimate treatments to help those with drug and alcohol dependency?
Thanks, Rochelle. It's Shalini, and really great to join you today. This is really interesting. It's an exciting space because there are lots of new things being trialed to treat drug addiction. And I think if we take a step back, we know that treatments for addiction have existed for some time, and there are a whole range of different types of treatments in this space. We know that addiction itself is a treatable illness. And so it's really great to be able to talk about what works and for whom.
It's quite an interesting one, because when we're talking about drug addiction and using drugs to treat drug addiction, it may raise some, alarm bells in some people's heads. Mm. Can you talk me through that? And I guess what are the benefits or the proven benefits in using certain drugs, like the two that we're looking at, ayahuasca and cannabis or CBD oil, in treating addiction?
Yeah, I think when we think about treatments, and this is true for any health disorder, when we think about whether something is an effective treatment, whether it's a safe treatment, we tend to apply the principles that we have, the frameworks that we have to assess any medicine. And so when we think about novel kind of approaches, ayahuasca, CBD, other things in the space such as psychedelics, what we're thinking about is applying the same scientific framework and principles to assess whether these approaches are going to be safe and effective for people who are living with addiction.
Is it a matter of time until something like psychedelics are discussed and are used in a more common and, of course, clinical setting? What we're talking about here is proper clinical settings and not underground or backyard or unregulated settings, because we don't see huge advances come about quickly when it comes to treating drug and alcohol addiction. So could this be a relatively exciting time for those like yourself that work in this sector?
Yeah, I think it is a really exciting time. I think if we take a step back and think about psychedelics, there was a huge range of research in this area around the 60s, and things just sort of halted from the 1960s until very recently. I think partly that's to do with stigma related to addiction, and that's also the reason why we don't necessarily have a whole range of treatment options available for people, because of that burden of stigma. That means people don't necessarily come forward to get help. We know that people don't necessarily get help because they also don't realize that addiction itself is treatable and that people can actually get treatments for it. So that burden of stigma has really kind of halted a lot of research in this space for quite some time. And then alongside, I think that stigma associated with psychedelic treatments and novel treatment approaches as well. And I guess the fact that these treatments are often based on medicines and plant-based medicines that are illicit in many countries. So that also has had a huge impact on research and been a barrier to research being conducted.
Shalini, we want to keep you there for 1 second. We've got a call up Vicky from Sunbury who's called through. Now, Vicky is a mental health nurse. What do you know about this topic, Vicky?
Well, I've been a mental health nurse for about 10 years, and what I've noticed personally and professionally is that traditional treatments can only work up to a particular point before we have to incorporate the body and somatic experiencing. If we look at some of the treatments available now, like EMDR, like tapping and yoga, that's actually helping the body to recognise that some of the trauma that people have experienced has been there for quite a while, and it's actually helping them to process it out. And psychedelics are an incredibly somatic experience for people, and I can credit them for being alive today.
I want to actually put that back to Shalini. Thanks so much, Vicky, for your call. I mean, I remember a family member talking to me about tapping, and that's something that Vicky just mentioned there, and I actually burst out laughing. I said, look, you can give me $100 and I'll come up and tap you on the shoulder. That's absolutely fine. I didn't even know what she was talking about. How much do you as a professional need to look at some of the ideas that many people will swear black and blue work for them? And as Vicky said, that she credits to keeping people alive. How do you work through what is legitimate and what you at, say, Turning Point take seriously and what you don't?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of work in this space in terms of body-based treatments, as Vicky was describing, for the treatment of PTSD and for trauma. And that's a really solid sort of science and literature behind that. I think when we look at new treatments and new treatment approaches, what's important is to really kind of apply that lens of what sort of trials have been done in this area. What is the framework that's been applied to this area? What is the replication of those trials? So for instance, if one individual has an experience versus a group of individuals in a small trial, and then the next step is, you know, actually scaling this up into large trials where we're looking for the signal that this is actually effective for many people or most people. And that's that process that that any medicine would go through for approval, for efficacy. And I think along that way as well, looking at safety and that's a really important aspect, I think, of trialing new kind of approaches is looking at whether this is going to be safe if it was rolled out and implemented more broadly as well.
Now, Shalini, you did mention earlier some trials that were done in the 60s or earlier on. Now, my understanding is that they were predominantly done around the likes of acid, which is also a hallucinative drug. I guess when you look at that, and I don't know if you could necessarily call it a failure of those sorts of studies, but they were stopped. So I guess where does the likes of ayahuasca differ from the studies that have previously been done in this sort of area?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I guess broadly speaking, a lot of that research into both psychedelics and then associated medications stopped largely because of a whole range of kind of concerns around the illicit nature, and also getting supply of that medication for use in trials and for research purposes became very challenging. And so that meant that labs and research teams couldn't necessarily actually further that that line of inquiry. Now, I guess revisiting this whole space, what we've got that we didn't have in the 60s is a whole range of new techniques, a whole range of new ways to actually look at the brain, look at the body, actually measure safety and efficacy in ways we couldn't back then. So I think that's where trials like the ayahuasca study that's been currently conducted can revisit that. I think the next guest you have will be able to speak much more knowledgeably on this topic, and I might leave that up to them.
Well, let's introduce him now. Jerome Sarris is with the Psyche Institute. He's a professor at Western University and the co-founder of the University of Melbourne's Medicinal Psychedelics Research Network, just to name a few. But he's also a big part of this ayahuasca trial that's being led by the Florey Institute of Neuroscience and Mental Health. That's at Melbourne's St Vincent's Hospital and Swinburne University. Jerome, text already coming in saying, I've used DMT, which is the active compound in ayahuasca. It was extremely life-changing and a positive experience. The stigma around psychedelics needs to be removed, and research may possibly lead to a revolution in mental health. And that's from Anonymous. I guess I'm preaching to the converted there when we say that this could be a revolution in mental health. Would you agree?
Well, look, certainly on the road to conversion, I think that we do need the science still to catch up, but there's incredibly positive preliminary science, as well as, like your caller said, certainly a lot of anecdotal evidence showing that, yes, look, it can be a very powerful, transformative healing experience for some people.
David, you've tried ayahuasca. Can you tell us a little bit about your experience and what you felt?
This was in the late 90s. This Brazilian lady, whose daughter was an exchange student in Frankston, she brought a bottle of it down to us, and we tried it on a couple of occasions. My whole family, that means my son was about 12, my daughter was in her late teens, and my wife was in her late 30s. We tried it out, and for me, it was like taking acid, but for my wife and my daughter, it was a very special, enlightening experience. For my son, it didn't matter at all.
Can I ask why you took it, David?
I just took it for fun, but this lady was very serious about it because her husband was a shaman back in Brazil, and she phoned him and got permission and played special music. It was a very religious thing for her.
It's quite interesting you say that she's from Brazil, because this is something that I've heard about through my friends who have travelled to parts of Central and South America to try ayahuasca. So it's an interesting thing, and it almost seems like it's become part of this tourism economy in that part of the world. What are your thoughts on that, Jerome?
Well, look, it is. I mean, obviously people couldn't travel that extensively through COVID. But look, people are also using it in a clandestine, for want of a better expression, way in Australia as well. So there are local shamanic ceremonies which happen. People have reported extremely positive benefits, but at the same time, we do also know, conversely, that people can have bad or negative experiences. Mm. There's also been issues overseas in terms of safety. So there are some risks and caveats around that, and that's why at Psyche Institute we're promoting the scientific investigation and the use of these agents within a medical framework for supervision as well as clinical psychology care, because if people do have even very positive experiences, they need to be able to integrate that into their lives, and that really does take some form of support mechanism after the experience.
We actually don't have David now, but lots of alarm bells went off for me. I don't know about the two of you during that call in terms of just how easily access it was, how little research was done, and the fact that it was given to children as well. Just to name a few, when we're talking about how common it's becoming, how celebrities are talking about using ayahuasca, are you worried that this will derail some of the scientific and clinical work that you're doing, Jerome?
Oh, absolutely not. I wouldn't say it would derail. I mean, I'd say it absolutely puts a greater spotlight on it, which is a mixed bag. I mean, there's a positive element in terms of people having, I guess, more of an open mind, and then that puts pressure on funding bodies, for example, to do good science regarding it. But, of course, there is the negative that you can get an overhype, and then you get people saying, oh, this could be for me. I'll just go off down the road, try to get some off the black market, and do it without the therapeutic framework, but also it may not be appropriate for them. And so, you know, that's why through a clinical trial framework, the person gets screened properly to see whether it is the right fit for them.
How important is that clinical setting when we're looking at things like this? I mean, we talk about people travelling overseas my friends who have done it and tried ayahuasca overseas have said it was, you know, they travelled to these remote communities. There was no sort of communication for a number of days, no access to phones, no access to internet. They're, you know, these communities didn't speak English, so there's that bit of a language. Like, it sounds scary when
they're
doing this.
The actual drug is accessed by a shaman as well. Here's a good description. Okay, so we've spoken about celebrities that have spoken about this. Now, Machine Gun Kelly, okay, most of us don't know who he is. He's a singer. He is, I think, engaged to Megan Fox, if that gives you any relevance whatsoever. But he gives a very interesting description of using this particular drug overseas. And this is him talking on one of the late night TV shows in the United States.
It was a circle of about 20 people, and you're in the forest or in the jungle. You're dieting. You're not eating past 5 p.m. or drinking water or anything. And I was the last person to go up and take it. And I remember watching everybody go up and take theirs. They had one cup, and they get to me, and the shaman says something to the translator, and the translator goes, "She says you have a big shadow of darkness behind you. You need more." On the third night, I remember. The shaman, he had like a bottle of tobacco water, and he did this thing where he went, and I saw like gray, like it would look like sand coming from my body, and I watched it go into, and he went. All jokes aside, it was one of the most important things that happened to me in my life.
Jerome Saras is with you. He's from the Psyche Institute, a professor at Western University. And Dr. Shalini Aaron Ogiri is with you as well, the director of Turning Point Drug and Alcohol Centre. Before we go back to Shalini on this, Jerome, how do you access this drug? Do you have direct contact with shamans? How do you get it?
Well, I mean, I'm probably not in a position to speak to how people may do that in a clandestine manner, because obviously the use of these drugs is scheduled in Australia. I think really it points to the fact that there are, for a certain amount of people, apart from people using it recreationally for that sort of an experience, but there are a lot of people who really have tried everything medically for their mental illness, and they see this as a last resort, and they have had a transformative experience. So you can imagine at that level of desperation that people do, you know, take it into their own hands. So in terms of getting hold of it, I mean, the work we do is obviously regulated, and we're using it rather than the traditional brew people consume, where we're prescribing and or giving it in a trial setting in capsule form. So it is regulated. It is, you know, created via good pharmaceutical practice. So it's a different process, but I couldn't speak to how people get it off the street, so to speak.
And Shalini, just want to bring you back into the conversation. What's your thoughts on, I guess, the benefits of these, or the importance of these clinical trials and it being held in a clinical setting as opposed to getting them from the black market and you know, travelling overseas to have these sort of out-of-body experiences?
Yeah, I think one of the things that Jerome hit on before is really the capacity to test whether it's a right fit. You know, we have quite rigorous screening processes in clinical trials to be able to be sure that the person's likely to benefit, but also it's likely to be safe. And I think safety is a really important part of all of this. The processes of clinical trials are actually also about screening and looking at adverse effects that might happen for people in a really robust way. So that at the end of a clinical trial process, when we bring people in for treatment, we're able to give them a really clear idea of what to expect. So that informed consent process is also really important. If we were to use these treatments as medicines for addiction or for other disorders, we need to be able to give people a clear idea of what to expect and what side effects, what adverse effects to expect, the same way we would do for any other medicine.
Jerome, when we spoke to you about almost a year ago when the Psyche Institute first opened, you actually said that you were working on this ayahuasca trial. Did it all go to plan? Were there any hiccups along the way? And how's it going in terms of getting the numbers and the right sort of people and the sort of backing that you need? Because some of the institutions that are behind this, you know, we're talking about Melbourne St Vincent Hospital and Swinburne University. These are very well-respected institutions, if anybody's questioning the work that you're doing.
Yes, absolutely. And also, I should say, at Nickham Health Research Institute, we also have a trial site. Look, it is coming along well. There is a lot of preparatory work around designing the protocol, creating the medicines to a standardised safe level. So that's where we're at, and we're preparing to start the study at the back end of this year. So all things are going well in that regard. I can't remember where we were last time, but we were fortunate enough to be awarded an MRFF grant for about $2 million from the government to do this study. And it's looking at people with major depressive disorder, alcohol use disorder, dual diagnosis, so depression and alcohol use disorder, and also we're potentially looking at trauma. So this is going to be a proper double blind, or I should say quadruple blind study, looking at these people with these disorders and using it within a medical clinical setting.
How does it actually work, Jerome? You talk about, particularly when you're looking at things like people who have experienced trauma, and when we hear stories of people taking ayahuasca, they say they had this awakening moment and they face their demons and all that sort of thing. But in a clinical sense, how does it work? Will you have a person there for several days and you know, they're on certain doses of it? And what sort of things are you doing to sort of monitor their symptoms and seeing if there are any progressions?
Yes, absolutely. Well, that's, and this is the key difference, I think, between a naturalistic experience of ayahuasca and through an actual clinical trial. Because in a clinical trial, we've got thorough screening. The person will have a few preparation sessions with a psychologist. Then they'll have a psychiatrist and a psychologist in the room with them when they get dosed. And then there'll be an integration session after that with a psychologist, and then they'll undergo three different doses, so three dosage experiences with the psychological integration sessions, and that can occur over about a 12-week period.
If people are texting and saying things like, I've been struggling with alcohol addiction and depression for several years now, currently doing a lot of counselling and therapy for it, I'd actually really like to put my hand up for trials like this. How do you go about putting your hand up for a trial?
Yes, well, we do have around Australia several which are kicking off in different areas. So, for example, aside from ayahuasca, there's also some work with psilocybin, the active constituent from magic mushrooms, and also some MDMA work which is going on. So I just encourage them to Google it, and if you know they get in contact with the trial leaders, they can screen them and see if they're appropriate. We won't be looking at recruiting until the end of the year, but certainly happy to chat to you more about it when we're underway.
Mark from Flemington has texted through saying, ensuring safety is critical, but I also think we need to be really careful when talking about treating mental illness with psychedelics. My understanding is that some serious psychiatric disorders, in particular psychosis and schizophrenia, can be exacerbated or brought on by the use of these psychedelics. Is this true, or I guess how can we monitor to ensure that these sorts of other disorders aren't coming through in these sort of treatments?
Well, absolutely right, and that's why we need for this to happen or be used, I think, within some sort of a psychotherapeutic framework, and that person gets screened, because people with bipolar disorder or schizophrenia, as examples, certain types of medication, those people will be screened out because of the chance of a negative effect from the agents.
Jerome, thanks so much for your time. We can hear the phone going off in the background. There's probably people ringing in to be a part of the trial, but you're super busy, so we'll let you go. Thanks for your time, as always.
No problem at all. Great to be with you. Thank you.
It's Jerome Saris. He's from the Psyche Institute. He's a professor at the Western University and co-founder of the University of Melbourne's Psychedelics Research Network, a part of this ayahuasca trial that's running alongside at Melbourne St Vincent's Hospital and Swinburne University later this year. Now, a couple of texts have come in, Michaela, saying, oh, be careful. You sound so casual when you're actually asking the researcher, where do you get it? You're not sounding very in control. Well, that's not really what I meant, but what we're talking in the past, when people talk about this, they talk about going into the deep, dark jungle and getting it from shamans and whatnot. So my question was more around, this is something that is nobody really knows or understands. It's very hard to access and it's very illegal in a lot of countries. So in terms of how they are accessing it, is it actually ayahuasca? Is it a derivative of? So it was more along those lines. I'm certainly not saying, how do you score it? Where do we go? That's far from what we're talking about. Mary's in Glenroy and has called through. Hi, Mary.
Yes, thank you. I'm an 81-year-old single pensioner. I have for the last, since mid-April, been on medicinal cannabis, the CBD brand, under the care of All Melbourne Hospital Pain Clinic, long-time pain from surgery on my feet, failed surgery 7 years ago. I only yesterday got a blow-up of the print on the package of the cannabis, and I had understood that it was the THC style of cannabis that is now thrown some people into the legal aspects of driving with it. But this blow-up of my CBD 100 says patients should not drive or operate heavy equipment. Well, I rely on my car. I'm not going to be doing heavy equipment. I rely on my car. I just want to know, please, since I've not had any side effects apart from the possibility of it aggravating some skin issues, but the inflammation certainly has not
subsided. So it's worked. Yeah, Mary, we have a couple of experts. So, and driving is often a question that has asked. So we'll put that to our experts. But can I just ask, how have you found it? And did you have any hesitations? I mean, being in your 80s when this was recommended to you as a form of pain medication, what was your first reaction?
I was reluctant, but I'd already seen an integrated rheumatologist previously on a private basis, and his treatment wasn't helping at all. And he said the next stage would be likely cannabis, and we've put that to the pain clinic at Royal Park, and I have been on that product. Just finished my first prescription, waiting to reassess if the skin rash condition could be my reaction to it. But it was also being surprised to have in the company print on the product that CBD 100 could be implicated.
All right, well, we'll put those numbers, Mary, to our experts. Thank you. Shalini, I mean, Mary's 81. When we spoke at the beginning that CBD oil, Michaela, is probably more common, more people may be using it for pain relief, all sorts of things. There is another trial that's about to start in using CBD for those actually with marijuana addiction. I guess, Shalini, in your time of practicing at Turning Point Drug and Alcohol Centre, is that where you've seen a huge leap in, I guess, changes and thought changes in treatment when it comes to CBD oil?
Yeah, look, I mean, I think there's a whole range of different medical cannabinoid products out there now. And, you know, what Mary was describing, it sounds like she's been prescribed something that has largely CBD in it. There are two main components with cannabis, and we have CBD, but also THC, as Mary described. And I think what's really important is that when people are prescribed things, they're aware of which product they're being prescribed, because some of the products can have a mix of both those components. Some products can have just the CBD. And they have very different properties and very different implications for both driving and also for just your day-to-day. But I think in terms of, you know, our practice in treating addiction, we see lots of people who find some of these approaches helpful. I think we're still, you know, early days in terms of being able to assess how useful and for whom these approaches work well.
Dr. Shalini Aaron-Ogiri is with you, Deputy Director of Turning Point Drug and Alcohol Centre. In just a moment, we'll look at a CBD trial that's about to start in Shepparton as well. Maybe you're considering being a part of one of these trials and want some more information. Good morning, Rochelle Hunt with you in Melbourne, Michaela Ortolan with you as well, coming to you from our Wodonga office. And we're talking about two new trials, Michaela, that looking at treating drug and alcohol dependency, but treating drug addiction with other drugs and illegal drugs as well. Well, previously some were seen as illegal.
It's quite interesting. I mean, we've spent a bit of time talking about ayahuasca, which is, you know, predominantly found in Central South America. It's a psychedelic drug. It's a bit more edgier. The other trial that we're talking about is the use of CBD oil. Now, that's a little bit more commonly used. And we had a caller on before who was using it for pain. And she was talking about the different components in CBD, one of them being the CBD and then the THC. We've got Edward Ogden from CBD oil trial leader, who's in Shepparton. Now, Edward, welcome to the show. You're leading the program or the trial that's being held in Shepparton. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. I'm a drug and alcohol specialist. And one of the things that struck me when I first started consulting in Shepparton was the number of people who were seeking help with their use of cannabis. And so it struck me that it might be worth looking at alternatives. And one of the things people who smoke cannabis often say is that they'd like to give it up, but they need it because it improves their mood or it helps them sleep. Now, we know that there are over 100 unique compounds in the cannabis plant, so-called cannabinoids. The two most important, as I heard mentioned before, are THC and CBD, so cannabidiol, which seems to have a fairly mellowing effect on a number of things. It's been suggested that it might be useful in a whole range of mental health conditions as well as its use in pain. And the other thing that struck me was that the TGA, the Therapeutic Goods Administration, decided last year that it would be permissible in the future for CBD to be sold over the counter. An S3, it's one of those things that would actually be behind the counter where you ask the pharmacist for it. And so one of the things that we were thinking about, well, if you could buy it over the counter, would it be useful for mood and sleep? And would that mean that people would find it easier to either reduce or stop smoking cannabis? So that was the sort of basis of the experiment we thought of running. So this trial, it actually looks like it might be fully subscribed this week, which is pretty exciting. And so we'll be providing people with either a blank capsule or one that contains low dose or high dose CBD, and just see what difference it makes over 3 months.
How different would it be to the ones that, say, would potentially, if it does go ahead, be available over the counter? And what sort of screening process, what sort of strengths are we talking about? Can you see any alarm bells with potentially not needing a prescription for something like CBD oil?
Well, the TGA has restricted it to 150 milligrams a day, which is pretty conservative. No, I don't see too many issues with that. CBD seems to be a fairly benign compound, you know, as long as it's purified. It's THC that's been associated with causing mental illness, and, you know, it may explain why the synthetic marijuana that's been around illegally for the last decade is so dangerous, because it's a synthetic form of THC and it doesn't have any CBD in it as a balancing compound. So, no, CBD by itself seems to be remarkably safe.
Can you talk us through those differences a little bit, Edward, just in terms of, you know, people who smoke cannabis versus taking this for a rehabilitation sort of...
Is that one addiction with another?
Yeah.
Well, the problem about smoking cannabis, of course, is you don't know quite what you're getting. And we know that, you know, there are 700 named cultivars of cannabis sativa, and you know, the plants are grown in a whole range of situations with different environmental conditions, different chemicals used, you know, and so the end result is you know, kind of an unknown mix of THC and CBD in the material. I mean, you know, other hemp products are grown. I mean, hemp is grown obviously for fibre and for hemp oil. And when it's legally grown in Australia, it has to have a very, very low THC content in the plant material.
So is it similar in any way to methadone being used to help treat those that are addicted to heroin and one drug being used to wean someone off another drug?
No, I don't think so. I mean, methadone is a pure opioid and you know, what you're really doing in many ways is substituting, a known safe product for, things that people are buying off the street. Whereas in this situation, what we're really sort of thinking about, well, is there part of this family of cannabinoids which is actually helpful for mood and sleep and is much safer? You know, methadone is not a particularly safe drug. Whereas what we think that, cannabidiol is really very safe.
Craig's called through from Geelong, and Craig, you've trialled CBD oil. What was your experience with it?
Oh, yeah, good morning. Great conversation. I had major back surgery back in the early 80s and suffered from chronic back pain, leg pain, nerve pain up until now. I'm now 61. And the addiction of the pharmacy drugs in Tramadol and Lyrica and all of that has been horrendous. I tried CBD oil through my doctor, started in February, slowly coming off the Tramadol and Lyrica, which is really, really hard. But my pain level has improved by easy 85%. I'm now able to work full-time on a concrete floor, 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, and haven't been able to do that in any form of comfort for many, many years.
Yeah, well, it seems like it has had a greater impact on your life, Craig. I'm interested in, I guess we talk about stigma, especially when we're talking about drugs and, you know, mentioning the fact that you've trialled CBD oil or a particular drug. There's a lot of stigma attached to it and generally that stigma is negative. What was the sort of reaction that you got from friends or family? I'm not sure if it is something that you've openly talked about with them, but if it is, what was the sort of reaction that you received from them?
Great if you deal with it the right way. I had a lot of, I tried to keep it quiet at my workplace, and I work in a shed full of guys in heavy equipment. And when it got out that I was on it, I got a few joking comments. And I just sat them down and explained that it's not hallucinogenic. It's this, it's that, it does this, it's, and they've seen the benefits, because these guys I've worked with for 10, 15 years, they've seen the benefit now, and now they're like, oh, wow, this is fantastic.
Craig, thanks so much for your call. Shalini, I'd like to put that back to you, because Craig mentioned something really important there. And when we look at painkiller addiction, which is a huge issue globally, but here in Victoria as well, and quite often people become addicted to these painkillers through an accident or through living with chronic pain. Have we seen a huge shift there when it comes to CBD oil, when it comes to maybe stopping other forms of addictions?
You know, people who come forth for treatment for opioid use disorder, we know that, you know, about 50% of them, sometimes higher, groups of people are actually coming from a history of being dependent on painkiller rather than necessarily being dependent on heroin or other illicit opioids. So, you know, this is a huge group of people who are needing treatment approaches. And I think when we think about CBD for that indication, I think we still don't know a lot about what sort of pain, who it works for best, whether pain in relation to having other mental health comorbidities as well means that the CBD is or isn't effective. And then in terms of dosing, I think that's also a really important part of the whole picture. So I think there's a lot of unanswered questions, but I think, at the moment there are both clinical trials currently underway to kind of unpack that, but also lots of treatment approaches that are in clinical practice, as we've heard now.
We're asking whether or not people would put their hand up to be a part of the two clinical trials that we're talking about today. Doug's in Cowra. Hi, Doug.
Hi, how are you?
Good, mate. What do you want to say?
Look, I'm a veteran and I have PTSD. Quite a few of my contacts have tried both cannabis and psychedelics as a treatment for PTSD and mental
disorders. It's the problem. The main problem they face is quality control. With street drugs, there is no quality control at all. And a lot of the research has been done using anecdotal evidence from people who use drugs.
So, Doug, can I just clarify? Are you saying that you know people that are trying this and they're experimenting it with it just with street versions as opposed to clinical trials, right?
Yes.
And I guess that's something that would alarm both Edward and Shalini as they're listening, because what we're talking about today is being able to have access to them in clinical settings. Doug, is it something that you would consider? Like, we spoke earlier about the Psyche Institute doing this, and we know Edward is running a trial in the Goulburn Valley. Would you consider it in a regulated clinical setting?
I have applied for the trial and... I think the term was clinically unsuitable, and I don't exactly know why, but I accept that. I wasn't a suitable candidate for the trial, but I definitely did apply for it.
And was that for the ayahuasca or for the CBD?
I really don't know. It was two trial psychedelics.
Okay. So it would have been the ayahuasca, at the psychedelic trial.
One of the interesting things was one of my friends went to America and... was in a group over there that had doctors who were experienced with American psychedelics. He came back to Australia and tried Australian mushrooms and found that they were far more powerful.
Yeah, it's risky.
Far more.
And this different. Is so certainly not what we're telling people to do today. Absolutely far from it. I mean, Edward and Shalini, does that worry you that people are already turning to the underground or going overseas and they're experimenting and doing their own trials, so to speak, without any medical intervention whatsoever?
Well, I mean, that's always the risk, isn't it, that for people who are suffering will turn to alternatives if what they've been offered is unhelpful. And I guess what, you know, the scientific world wants to do is to sort of say, well, you know, can we actually work out what's useful and what's not? You know, if you use things which you've obtained off the street, as the last caller suggested, we don't know quite what you're getting. And the advantage of the scientific method is that you can actually try different things and different doses and see what's really useful. I mean, I'm actually at St. Vincent's today, which is my other home, and you know, we're looking for people between 18 and 28 to try cannabidiol for cannabis use and mood disorders. So there's quite a lot of, you know, interest in the scientific world to try and work out what's useful and what's not.
We could probably spend an entire another show talking about this, Rochelle, with whether or not that, you know, age-old debate or whether or not decriminalisation of drugs does have an impact on the black market. Shalini, what's your take on that? Would decriminalising certain drugs like cannabis and these drugs that are used in trials to treat certain things, would it have an impact and make it safer for the community?
I think they're two probably quite separate issues. I think decriminalisation is associated with a whole lot of benefits in terms of for people who use drugs specifically. But then I think then the separate question around, you know, studying whether these are effective treatments for different indications is probably a separate issue. I do think the context in which we're kind of having this discussion is important because, you know, these conversations are happening and people are accessing these substances. So when they do come into a trial, I guess that's the question around sort of the hype of it and what they expect and that expectancy effect. So it is a really important issue to kind of think about when we do clinical trials and studies to be able to understand that impact that has on the result.
Edward, just finally, lots of people saying, how do I get information about this trial? There's multiple trials that you're running at the moment. What's the best way of people accessing information either on the trial that's running at the Goulburn Valley Alcohol and Drug Service or the one that you're talking about at St. Vincent's?
Well, I think the one in Shepparton is likely to be fully subscribed this week, but I can give you a phone number for St. Vincent's if anyone's interested.
Yep, give it to us quickly now if you want.
Yeah, so that's 03 9231 6947.
All right. Well, your phone may run off the hook, and so we'll let you go. Go deal with
that. Okay. And if I could just get one word in before you get rid of me. The issue that's been raised is about the cannabinoids and driving. And I think it's important to sort of clarify what we know. If I change hats and say that I'm a former secretary of the International Council on Alcohol, Drugs and Traffic Safety, maybe what I'm about to say might make some sense. THC has been shown to seriously impair driving. So people who smoke cannabis, particularly if it's high in THC, are impaired and often don't know it. So if you interview them, you get comments like, I drive better when I'm stoned, I feel more in touch with my car, which might be their impression, but in fact they don't drive better. CBD has been reasonably well studied so far in terms of driving, and although the company will warn you not to drive for obvious reasons, there is no evidence that CBD impairs driving. And CBD is not detected by roadside testing. The roadside testing and the blood testing done by law enforcement agencies is looking for THC.
Edwin, it's been fascinating speaking with you. Thank you for the work that you do. It's interesting.
Oh, it's fun. I look forward to having some results. And
Get back in touch. People are certainly interested in it. Edward Ogden, there's the CBD oil trial leader in Shepparton. And Michaela, listening to this as well, has been Dr. Paul Grinsey. And he's a lead trainer in addiction specialist. Paul, you're at the Royal Australian College of General Practitioners as a lead trainer in addiction. Where do clinical trials, especially sort of edgier ones, I guess, like ayahuasca, which we started at the beginning of the program, a psychedelic trial, where do they fit into addiction training, do you think?
Oh, good morning, everyone. I find this area fascinating. As a GP, we deal with the whole person, not just a sub-segment of their health needs. And so we see the broader picture. And we've got many, many tools available to us to offer our patients for a number of different health conditions, including alcohol and other drugs. And so when I'm hearing about these trials, I get very excited, not because I think, here we go, we've got a new treatment necessarily, but because there's a process in place to ensure that there's, like Shalini has mentioned, there's some safety around what may end up something that I can use as a tool in my practice, but also knowing where it's applicable and maybe where it's not applicable. So these sort of trials are very helpful to give us potentially some more tools, or if they don't work, at least we know that we advise our patients not to go there because they're not helpful and it's been proven not to be helpful. And so I wouldn't be prescribing any of these at this stage without some good evidence of where they're useful and also the harms and balances, so that I can advise my patients appropriately.
Do you think we're a little way off then? I guess these trials are just starting now, but is it a few years down the track before we can safely say that, yes, the likes of ayahuasca and CBD oil and those sorts of other drugs can be used to treat addiction?
I think, I can just take a big step back here. When you say treat addiction, as I see it, when we look at the criteria for addiction, there's some physical manifestations of it, but a lot of them are social and psychological. They affect relationships, how they affect work, how they affect all those things. And that's what I see as a GP. And so when I am treating addiction, we may be using a medication or, in your words, a drug to treat a drug. And that's at the moment for alcohol and opioids only. There's no real evidence for other drugs. But we're using those as tools, but only part of a toolkit. And for me, when we talk about rehabilitation, often people think about rehabilitation as a place to go and get rehabilitated. But for me, it's a process. It's a lifelong process. And someone who's suffered from an addiction will often have the social or relationship issues that they've got to repair. There may be some physical health issues they've got to repair. There may be some psychological issues that not repair necessarily, but optimise so they can actually live a better life. And for me, that's rehabilitation. And so these tools, which include some of the drugs and medications that may be coming on board, are only part of the bigger picture, and they certainly won't be the panacea of all addiction.
And when you talk about rehabilitation being a place, that was something that we contemplated bringing into today's conversation as well, because we're seeing more funding just recently going to 30 new rehabilitation beds in Mildura. We've seen rehabilitation centres open up in Traralgon as well. When we talk about the funding behind these trials, does it then mean that money gets taken away from the places, like from beds and rehabilitation, or can they work side by side? Is the pool great enough for that? I'll put that to you, Paul.
Look, I think if you're looking at health funding, the pool is never going to be big enough to appease all the gods. But the look, I don't think they're competitive necessarily. I think these trials are funded separately as research trials as opposed to funding services in as you've described, some very important regional services. And rehabilitation programs can be either live-in, so residential rehabs, or things people can go in as, I suppose, an outpatient staying at home. And they're very important. They don't suit everyone. And so we need a range of tools in our toolkit so they can match the needs for individual patients and not just a one-size-fits-all approach.
Dr. Paul Grinsey, thanks for your time.
Pleasure.
And Dr. Shalini Aaron-Ogiri has been with you throughout the program. We asked you for half an hour. We've kept you for an hour, but it's been fascinating, Shalini, speaking with you. I guess just your final closing comments on the future of these trials. How long until you can use it as evidence, like Paul just said, do you think?
Yes, I think it's a really exciting time to be practicing in this field. And I think, you know, we've heard about a number of studies currently here in Australia, but also in a vacuum, and there's a number of studies currently underway in the US. I think, you know, in terms of this space, we're going to have results from many of these studies and certainly in the next couple of years. So I think the, you know, treatment space is probably going to look a little bit different in the coming decade.
Absolutely. Stay tuned. It sounds exciting for sure to be a practitioner at this time. Thank you, Shalini, for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And the one thing I think I took away, Rochelle, was that it's definitely just one tool in the toolbox. If we're looking at this issue as a whole, there's, you know, some methods work for some people, some don't work for others, but it's a whole range of things that can be pulled together and used to help treat things like addiction.
Absolutely. And as we just touched on at the end, rehabilitation and beds, and that's something that I think we'll look into down the track. I know that there's probably many being needed where you are in Wodonga. There's many that are opening, 30 new beds are opening in Mildura. We've just seen, as I said, a big new rehabilitation centre open up in Traralgon as well. So where that space is at the moment, because there is a huge call for more state-funded rehabilitation in actual beds, because people then, you know, reach out to private operators and we know get ripped off or pay far too much as well. So that's been a huge issue. It's been fascinating, though.
It has. It's an interesting topic to talk about, that's for sure. Eye-opening.
Thanks so much for listening, and we look forward to spending time with you soon.